This is Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Ken Nash and Mimi Rosenberg. We're saying from Ferguson to Staten Island, building resistance to police terror and the policies and practices that lead to mass incarceration and the consequences. We're very pleased to have with us Carl Dix, who has been down in the town of Ferguson. He co-initiated a mass civil disobedience campaign to stop the NYPD's illegitimate racist policy and practice of stop and frisk. He's currently spearheading national efforts to make the month of October a month of resistance to mass incarceration, police terror, repression, and the criminalization of a generation. He's a longtime leader and representative of the Revolutionary Communist Party. And going back to the 1970s, he was a member of the Fort Lewis Six, the largest mass refusal of active duty soldiers for orders to Vietnam, for which he spent 2 years in Fort Leavenworth Military Penitentiary. And also with us is Michael McPherson. Michael lives in the area. Michael is with Veterans for Peace, and I believe they actually had a demonstration in response to the incredible militarization that is going on down in the area at the governor's office. And Shahid Buttar, who is the executive director of the Bill of Rights Defense Committee. Why don't we start with Mike McPherson as the resident of St. Louis? Perhaps you can contextualize the anger and the pain from this immediate police murder of Michael Brown, but certainly an event that is prevalent or descriptive of the systemic racism that exists within Missouri in Ferguson.
Thank you for having me on the show. Just want to let people know that I'm originally from North Carolina and lived in Newark really for the past 4 or 5 years and worked with the People's Organization for Progress a great deal. And I've been to St. Louis. This is actually my third time living here. And from the first time I lived here in 96, 97, I learned a lot about just how divided and segregated the city of St. Louis and surrounding area is. North St. Louis is where predominantly black community lives. South St. Louis is mixed. And then you have the further out suburbs. Just about everything when it comes to politics, everything has to do with race here. A lot of people have given up on life getting better in St. Louis. So with the mistrust with the police department and the abuses that I've heard for years, it's not surprising that when Michael Brown was shot, that there was an explosion of anger. And I think the biggest reason, the fact that Michael Brown laid on the pavement for 4.5, close to 5 hours, with no one even trying to see if they could save him, and the whole community seeing that, and then the police officer not being arrested, it just proved to people over and over that no one cares about them. So I think that's why we continue to see the rage that we see, the lack of transparency, and the fact that no one seems to care.
And Shahid Buttar, I wanted to ask you, and we're going to talk a lot later about the militarization of the police department, both throughout the country and also in Ferguson, but what is your initial reaction to what's going on there now?
It really reflects the continuation of a pattern that we've seen across the country. While I would like to suggest that it ends at the suppression of dissent by communities of color responding to police brutality, unfortunately, that's just the beginning. And we see this phenomenon, essentially, of the militarization of local police becoming a cash cow. And you can observe it in a cross-whole sphere of seemingly separate policy areas. I've spoken about surveillance drones and their increasing availability to local police departments. It's no different than, for instance, the automatic license plate scanners, which police around the country, that's a fait accompli. They've already been rolled out. And these are military technologies developed by the Pentagon to suppress foreign populations. And those technologies are finding their way through Department of Homeland Security grants and Department of Justice grants into the hands of local police departments. That has incredibly profound consequences, not only for the right to assembly, which we see so visibly disrupted in Missouri, and not only disruptions of the right to speak and petition the government for redress of grievances, as we saw, for instance, suppressed during the Occupy movement. But what we see in Ferguson is a sort of fusion of those abuses, a 14th Amendment discriminatory bias policing on top of those abuses, and insulating all this from public accountability is the secrecy that has enabled police departments around the country to essentially adopt not just SWAT team tactics, but across their police department, these training weapons and tactics that really have no place in a civilian population.
Carl, of course, the media here continues to play out. For example, they say that this evening the curfew is lifted and they want to see if they can quell the dissent and abuse and opportunism in the area that is prevalent by virtue of people coming in from the outside, that it is not a situation of anger and disruption. It is a criminal element that has lodged itself in the neighborhoods, exploiting the death of Carl Brown. What do you see going on the ground, and how do you respond to that?
First off, there is a criminal element in the streets in Ferguson, but they are in police uniforms. And they have been carrying out their criminal activity against the people here for a very long time. And what has happened is that people have said, this is it. We will not take this anymore, and stood up in the wake of the murder of Michael Brown. It was the horrific nature of the murder, shooting the man six times. And then not only left his body laying there for hours, they forced people who came try to aid Michael away and put out calls for additional police forces from neighboring jurisdictions to come in and help them carry out crowd control. And then you add to that, they would give no information. They wouldn't say how many shots were fired, how many shots hit Michael Brown. They wouldn't say who the police officer was. And people had been through this before, but this was too much. They were not going to take it this time. They have been in the street in the face of all of that militarized weaponry, you know, because drones have been deployed here. They have had sound cannons out trying to drive people off out of the streets. They fired tear gas at people. They've been out in their armored personnel carriers. And despite all of that, people, and especially young people, have been out every night since Michael's murder, demanding the indictment of the cop, speaking venom about the police chief here in the Ferguson area and the need to get rid of him. This has reached people around the country and even around the world. The first night that tear gas was used, I was on Twitter spreading the word about that, and I noticed that tweets were coming from Gaza to the people in Ferguson with instructions for how to deal with tear gas. Because they're sending a message of intimidation with this militarization and bringing in higher levels of military organization. But it's also an indication that they are afraid that what people are doing here in Ferguson could impact people all around the country who are dealing with the same issues that people here in Ferguson are. Because this is not the only place where the police murder Black and Latino people and get away with it with impunity, as people are acting around the murder of Eric Garner in New York, around the murder of Ezell Ford in Los Angeles. This could spread nationwide. They fear that. And people here in Ferguson are proud that people around the country are looking at what they're doing. And they are elated when they find out that someone has come from somewhere else. When I mention that I'm from New York, people hug me and thank me for coming down. I mean, the people out on the street don't have a problem about outside agitators. That's something that the media and the authorities are worried about. But their worry should not be about the people who have come from New York and Chicago. It should be about the people here in Ferguson who are refusing to take it.
Michael McPherson, Governor Christie, a pretender to the throne of the presidency, came out with a statement that under no circumstances should the death of Michael Brown be considered to reveal a larger truth. It's an isolated, is a singular incident. What's your response?
That's absurd, and it's clear to many people and people of many races. So, you know, because we're working, like the action you just spoke about, Veterans for Peace joined with the Organization for Black Struggle and did an action in downtown St. Louis to try to force the governor to pull back the National Guard. And there were some arrests in trying to do that. So there's a broad coalition of different ethnic groups and different people of different colors who clearly understand that this is a serious problem across the region and around the country. It's just not about police. That's where it's most deadly. But this is an economic and political struggle, because like there in Ferguson, it's 67% African-American, but the leadership in the mayor's office, the city council, are run by white people. Black people there really don't have much power, and we have that in many places around the country. And then on top of that, you have police abuse. So that's a totally ridiculous statement for him to make, and shows either that he's out of touch or he's trying to paint a narrative to continue to maintain the status quo. That's all it is.
And I wonder if you can comment on the, again, victimization, this time of Michael Brown, by the release of a videotape, which may or may not have been Mr. Brown, and which, in any event, doesn't appear to have any relevance to the shooting. And certainly, who gives a damn if somebody did shoplift? Is that a crime for which you lose one's life? I'm just incensed at the effectiveness of the media play of trying to make the person who lost their life, who is the victim, the...
demonizing him.
Yeah.
Yes, right. So,
and frankly, all three of you, if you can really comment on that.
In my office here in St. Louis, one of my staff members' son was killed years ago, not by the police, but by a former police officer. So he had friends, you know, in the police department and other places. And part of the tactic, it's exactly the same thing, which we see all many, many times. And it's a flashback for her. They did the same thing to her son. They tried to say that he broke into someone's home as part of trying to make him look bad. So to taint the jury pool, which is exactly what they're trying to do here, is to make Michael Brown look like he's a criminal so that it's more legitimate what the police officer has done. And we've seen this constantly, where the police kill someone and then they trickle out information that may or may not be true, that has nothing to do with the killing, to make the person look bad. All of us black people, and I'm an African-American person, we're supposed to be criminals anyway. And then if you get a predominantly white or all white jury, the person is likely to get off. It's very thoughtful, and the same pattern that we see over and over.
Just to chime in here, this is Shahid. It really strikes me as emblematic of the same pattern we see in other contexts. When I think about rape culture, blaming women who are victimized and attempting to excuse their abusers. I don't think it's anything different here, and it reflects a devious strategy by the police and the government authorities there, the local government authorities, to turn the tables on the debate by painting Mr. Brown, again, who is never adjudicated. I think that's a crucial piece to remember here, as a criminal. And what basically happened in Ferguson, Missouri, and what happens in cities around the country are summary executions of people on the basis of mere suspicion. And I want to link this to a controversy that was really, quite frankly, gripped the nation about a year ago when the current CIA director was up for confirmation before the Senate Intelligence Committee. Senator Rand Paul, Republican from Kentucky, filibustered the confirmation of that nomination because he wanted an assurance from the Justice Department saying specifically that drones would not be used to assassinate U.S. citizens without trial within the United States. And whether it happens by a drone or whether it happens by six bullets, two to the head from a police officer, it's the same abuse. We're talking about extrajudicial assassination. And that's illegal under every conceivable law you could fathom. In multiple provisions in the Constitution, international treaties, there's no greater abuse. And that's exactly what happened here. And I think the effort to paint Michael Brown as a criminal, again, who was never adjudicated in advance of the officers responsible for his death facing justice, reflects a very clear political stratagem. And I just say, in addition to that, when we look at the events in St. Louis and we look at that claim by Governor Christie about this being an isolated incident and a few bad apples, you know, we heard the same thing about Abu Ghraib, only to discover years later, and we're still fighting about this just to get the mere facts, that those abuses went also much further than were acknowledged. And I think, you know, if Governor Christie thinks this is an isolated incident, I would invite him to try walking in the shoes for a day of any low-income community of color around the United States and see if he still feels that way after that.
Let me get in on this, too, because the dehumanization of black people has been part of the American narrative since before there was an America. It was part of the justification for the enslavement of people from Africa. It was part of the justification for the old Jim Crow, the special laws to hold down black people, because, of course, these were people who were criminal, who were lusting after white women and to commit various crimes, so they had to be held in place. And it's part of the narrative of today, only today it's happening in different conditions. The forcing of large sections of especially the African-American population out of the employed sector of the workforce, reducing them to various hustles, legal or illegal, in order to survive. And then the targeting of people who are get involved in those hustles with the weight of the criminal injustice system. We see it in New York with the broken windows theory, where you sell loose cigarettes, you sell swipes in the subway, and all like that. You are become the focal point of the NYPD's effort. And that effort can be murderous, as we saw in the case of Eric Garner. And we really saw it because it was caught on videotape. But it happens all across the country. There's not a theory that the police in Ferguson use, but it comes down to the same thing, brutalizing and murdering black people and then justifying all that by demonizing the people that you brutalized and murdered. It is part of a program that has an overall genocidal thrust, and we have to look at it that way because genocide's a process, and we have to recognize the process and attack that process and stop it before it gets to the final stage. And that is why in the Stop Mass Incarceration Network, which I co-founded with Cornel West, we've raised the slogan, mass incarceration plus silence equals genocide. Act to stop it now. And that's part of what drove me to come down to Ferguson, because people in Ferguson were acting to take on that genocide and drawing the eyes of the country and the world to it. And I felt a need to stand with them, but also to work to knit the resistance further together as a nationwide movement of resistance, and to make all of that a part of taking it to a much higher level with the October month of resistance to mass incarceration, police terror, repression, and the criminalization of a generation, the way in which they are not allowing people to protest, the fascist-type measures, the rolling away of the right to protest. That's what's being put down here in Ferguson. People are standing up against it, and it's very important that people stand with them, and that's something that I intend to do.
Michael, you're a long-term resident of the area. Does any of this surprise you of what the reaction of the power elite within Ferguson to the situation?
No, I have to say I was a little Sunday morning, I woke up, I didn't even hear about the killing on Saturday. I woke up and heard a story about it, and I just thought to myself, oh no, here we go, we're going to have to go through the struggle to make sure this guy gets indicted and all that. But I did not expect there to be a rebellion. Then I turned the radio on late Sunday night. That's when I heard what was going on. So while I didn't expect it, because this is not the first time this has happened, being out here or around the country, and St. Louis, actually, in the 60s, early 70s, where many places were having what some people call riots, where we realize the uprising or rebellion, St. Louis city itself did not have that. That happened over in East St. Louis. In some ways, many people here feel like black people are complacent, which isn't entirely true, because there is a vibrant activist community here. So once that rebellion started, and then talking to people about the attitude of the Ferguson Police Department, and I don't know how true this is because I don't live in Ferguson, but I'm under the impression that they had decided that they were going to be the biggest and baddest gang, and that when we approach at least certain people, you're going to understand that you're going to have respect for me because I'll hurt you, you know. So once I started hearing some of these things about things that had happened in the past, then it became clear to me, no, I'm no longer surprised at all by the way that they reacted, because that's how they've been operating. And this is the reason that there's been this explosion of people in Ferguson, because like Carl said, and everyone here, we're just not going to take it anymore. And let me just say, I went down there and talked to some young people, you know, asking them, are you planning to leave? Are you planning to stay? Some of them told me they're planning to leave. One young man told me, I'm staying here because I'm going to defend my territory. So one thing I know about people, people want to matter. You know, people want to feel like they're part of something, and people are talking about this is going to make history. And it is making history. So people want to change, and they want to matter, and this is not going to quell until they see some form of justice. So they believe that what they're doing is going to make a difference. And if they don't see that coming, then they're probably just going to keep on going.
Shahid, what is to be done? Here are young people that are facing down full military gear and so on. Is it a matter now of we need to get a special prosecutor, which would be very difficult, actually, in the context of the laws of the state of St. Louis? We need to get rid of Bob McCullough. He should not be the one before the grand jury prosecuting this case. We should arrest the police officer, Darren Wilson. We should remove the local police chief who was such an aggressor and tyrant in response to the community. We should assure that, my goodness, you have, what, I think 3 to 5 African-American policemen in the context of a 53. There are 3 blacks in the Ferguson Police Department. Are these the things that we need to begin to focus on, and also on a broader level, making sure that these kinds of armaments and military might are not used in our communities, criminalizing, terrorizing a population with this kind of absolute overkill?
And I think it's worth, you know, putting this in a couple lenses. So first, with respect to the personnel decisions, getting a special prosecutor in place, the Justice Department investigation, for instance, replacing the police chief, and going further, let's talk about diversifying the police force in Ferguson. All those are beginnings. None of them will suffice. And, you know, Exhibit A for that, the LAPD, the NYPD, those are forces that are significantly diverse in terms of the officer population. They are still institutionally racist, right? Ensuring more representativity in the police department, more representation of the community, for instance, the demographics of the community where they're working, I don't think that's enough by a long shot to give us any comfort the constitutional rights will be respected. The second place where you took it, I think at the very least, council should be putting in place accountability mechanisms, transparency measures, limits on police authority, and structural reforms that will force police departments into the public eye and to create accountability opportunities for these kinds of abuses. But beyond even that, discrete policy reforms do not a paradigm shift make. And the only way for that to happen is for the individuals at fault, in this particular case, certainly to be reassigned, for Ferguson and other communities around the country to adopt affirmative, proactive policing reforms. I would really love to see Congress do something, or the president, who, you know, ran for office to a large degree promoting his own history in the Illinois State Senate on racial profiling measures. It's the Obama administration still hasn't endorsed the End Racial Profiling Act, which I think is preposterous. And I really do hope that every one of the president's supporters takes advantage of this opportunity to ask their people in the White House, what are you thinking and where have you been? You know, that's another policy step. But beyond all that, you know, this really will take a grassroots movement of millions to restore the constitutional rights that are embedded in, again, the constitution of our republic. There is no more fundamental law, and just as there are a few laws that are more widely disrespected than the same ones that constrain the kind of abuses that we've seen in Missouri more recently. And whether it's the extrajudicial and arbitrary assassination of an unarmed black man, or whether it's the kind of similar profiling abuses that aren't so extreme that happen every minute in this country. Those are all issues that we should all be concerned about, whether it's profiling, whether it's brutality, whether it's the inappropriate escalation of force, whether it's the suppression of dissent. What those things all share in common is run amok police. And we put our concerns, whether they're about local spying, whether they're about profiling, whether they're about brutality or integration with federal immigration enforcement, there are all these different ways in which local police abuse our rights. And I do hope that if nothing else, like corporations have proven sufficient to band America together against a common foe, I do hope that the overreaches of our police departments may be the thing to inspire we, the people of the United States, to remember what we hold most dear.
Carl?
Yeah, and I think one very important thing, because I made the point earlier that I think it's going to take revolution, nothing less. But in relation to that, I also want to make the point that very clear demands
forward in the struggle here in Ferguson. Indict the cop. People want to get rid of local police chief Jackson, and they are demanding an open and accountable investigation that does not become something to try to stretch out and cool people out. And there's an important relationship between fighting for these demands and building a movement, because when people get hit with something like this, if they stand up, if they fight, if demands are brought forward that draw clear dividing lines and that enable you to bring broad sections of people to stand on the correct side of those dividing lines. And that is happening here, because one thing that people make very clear that they find very important is that although the people who are mainly abused here are the majority black population of Ferguson, they welcome everyone who wants to stand with the struggle for justice. And, you know, they make that very clear when they welcome people joining in. And if people can fight and win some of these demands, get this cop indicted, you actually get people who can stand up and begin to see farther. We call it a strategic thrust of fight the power and transform the people for revolution. Through the course of fighting back, bringing an understanding of where do these problems come from? Why is it that African Americans who fought so hard to end the old Jim Crow now face what Michelle Alexander calls a new Jim Crow? How does that relate to the developments in the economy? And what's needed to deal with this problem once and for all? That's the process of fight the power and transform the people for revolution. And that's something that we're involved in right now here in Ferguson. And a key part of that is actually building a fight to win these demands. You know, they're not being raised to try to get people moving and get them behind us. We actually have to build a fight for this, and people want to build a fight. Let me give the website where people can find out about the October month of resistance and get involved. It's stopmassincarceration.net. That's stopmassincarceration, all one word, .net.
Shahid Buttar, Executive Director of the Bill of Rights Defense Committee, Michael McPherson with Veterans for Peace down in St. Louis, and Carl Dix with the Committee Against Mass Incarceration, getting ready for the October month of activism, as we all must. I really want to thank you all. Well, this has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg
and Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.